Quest for Proposal national webcast, and we're here to respond to your questions and answers. Just let me do some housekeeping things before we get started. If you're on the phone, not have a mute button, I would like you to do *6. That will put everything on mute. And when you want to talk to us, you would do #6. And for those who are not familiar with the CARE program, we have these national webcasts every year when the RFP is on the street. And what we do is just go over a quick PowerPoint slide presentation that tells you a little bit about the program. And then what you need to do is go right into your questions and answers. I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. My name is Marva King, and you've seen my name a lot of places. I am the CARE Program Grants Team Lead. In the room with me, I have my colleagues who work with you, and you've seen Dennis O'Connor's name, I'm sure, plenty of places. And Dennis is beside me, and Michelle Mandolia is also here, and she is our Measurement Evaluation Team Lead. And she will be the moderator for this session. And basically, we're just going to go over, like I said, the presentation, and then we're going to answer questions and answers. I also should have on the phone someone from the grants office who will be helping us with particular grant-type questions, and that would be either Catherine Voss or Frank Roth. And all of our bios and pictures are on the webpage that you would have went to the register. Just as a caveat, we may not answer every one of your specific questions. The reason to that is we do not talk about specific projects if you can do a certain thing or not, only because it just would take so much of our time. And it would be helping you write your proposal, so we don't do that. But we will ask, answer as many questions as we can. I do want to let you know that there is a question and answer document on our website that if we don't answer your question, it is probably there somewhere. And what we expect for these calls is update that question and answer document to make sure that we have the again, as I said at the beginning, if you could please put your phone on mute, that would help us. We have almost 200 people who will be participating on this webcast today. So *6 is a mute, and #6 is when you want to talk. And so what we're going to do, let me just repeat my thought about the question and answer document. Dennis O'Connor is very good about updating that question and answer document. We update it after these calls, so please check next week. We have another call Friday. So after today's call and after Friday's call, we'll probably be updating that document. So please check next week about anything that you may think you have missed. And again, as you know, the proposals are due March 9th. So we're going to just jump right into it so that we can get right to your questions and answers. And I'm going to ask Michelle to go to the PowerPoint slide. And I think it's probably slide, do the arrow again. Yeah. So it's a slide that starts, what is CARE? And it tells you that, so hopefully if you are not on the web, you've already downloaded this. But I will go over the slides in case you don't have them.
5 minutes.
The slide says, what is CARE? And it tells you that we're a community-based, community-driven program. And we're created to build partnerships, local partnerships, to help communities understand and reduce their risk from all sorts.
I'm going to just type it right here.
So again, put your phone on *6 for me. I can hear conversation.
Oh, that's all right.
please mute your phone. I can hear a couple of people's conversation. And to mute, it's star 6.
Coming up.
Next slide. Okay, sir, I can still hear you. It's a gentleman. Please, will you check your phone to make sure it's on mute? As I said, we have 200 people on this call today. Next slide is why care? What, you know, why is there a care program? Why, you know, do we want to have this program? And we did this in response to community requests for help. We received requests from all different types of arenas. One of them was an advisory council on environmental justice. Another one was just people calling in and telling us they need some help to reduce risk in their neighborhoods, and they wanted to do it themselves and not have someone else studying them and getting the money for that. And so that's why we developed this program. It was also developed as a means to address concerns that are beyond the reach of national regulation. Everything cannot be gotten to with our regulations. It was to integrate agency programs to improve support for all communities. It was to mobilize new resources and use local knowledge to achieve results. And it was to help develop community consensus around what these sources of pollution risks were and how to reduce them. The next slide talks about our care goals, and these goals are in your RFP. So I will not read them. Please look in the RFP for those goals. They are listed here. But they are definitely in your RFP, so I need you to make sure that you read your RFP. And I'll tell you where they are. They're on page, they're under section 1 of your RFP, B, on the scope of care projects. And B1 is care goals, and B2 is care strategies. So basically the next 3 slides are about those. Care goals is one, and care strategies is the other. And so, like I said, I don't think I have to read these because, of course, you are reading your RFP, hopefully. The next slide, Michelle, is a schematic, and it talks about how care works. And basically, it does 4 things. It tells us about care joining together and identifying your problems and your solutions and coming to consensus around those. And that's basically your level 1. You form a partnership, you join together, you do an assessment of what your problems are in your community, and this assessment is broader than an environmental assessment. It also can be a socioeconomic and environmental health assessment. And you come to consensus around what do you want to address first, and how you can, which of the priorities you want to address first. And 3 and 4 is basically your level 2. And it's where you have identified all the concerns, you prioritize them, and you decide now you have options. And so you figure out how you're going to do that and how you're going to reduce risk. And you do that with a level 2, which is a little bit more money. It's up to $300,000. And then you also have to articulate to us how you're going to keep going and reducing these risks and evaluating what you're doing and still carrying on after the federal funds are gone. Next slide, Michelle. So we always tell you about what CARE does in the agency. We ask you to be a collaborative partnership across the agency, but we do the same thing. We ask you to be a collaborative partnership across your community. But we do the same thing here in the agency. We work with a lot of our different programs, environmental justice programs, watershed programs, brownfields programs. We work across the agency to build relationships to help you do your work better. At the same time, we have a strong Washington, D.C. headquarters relationship with your regional partnership. When you become a CARE grantee, a team is built for you around your project, and we work with that team very closely. So in a way, CARE is our unique way for us to demolish some of those agency hierarchy stovepipes that are out there, and for us to work together across the agency as a matrix for you. And it's also a way where we can try to start looking at some of this cumulative risk problems that you have in your community. It also is a two-way communication between EPA and you. Next slide, Michelle. And so, again, I've already said that it's a nationally competitive cooperative remit. A level one is worth up to around $90,000. A level two is worth up to around $275,000.
You have reached the recording limit. The message has been sent.
We're calling St. Vincent's Episcopal House.
Hello. Please put your phone on mute.
Sorry, extension only. You might dial it at any time.
I don't know what that is.
If you're talking directly, please press 7. Or remain on the line, or dial 0 to leave a general message. Mm-hmm. Once again, thanks for calling.
I don't know. We'll just go on. I hope you guys can hear me. So level 1, I'm sorry, I said average of 90,000.
Please hold a moment.
Receive up to 100,000. And a level 2 is an average of 275, but you can receive up to 300. Next slide, Michelle. The next slide talks about all the money we've given out so far.
Extension 1, 3. Does not answer. Start recording at the tone. When you are done, press the pound key or hang up.
I apologize for that. It's not us. It's someone out there of your 200 people on the line.
They're going to get an interesting voice.
Yeah. So far, the CARE program has been in existence for 5 years, and we actually have about 77 grants out there. We're operating in 68 communities, and we are up to $12 million of funding. Next slide, Michelle. So we always say care is more than money, because it is. But as I was telling you, when you receive a CARE award, a regional team is built around your CARE grant. And so we offer you technical support and information. We offer you scientific expertise, community planning, help and understanding which voluntary programs can work well with your project. We have a networking opportunity that, and shared learning that is done through our CARE workshop and through our listserv with our CARE community. Next slide, Michelle. This is our tools, CARE tools for community slide, and this is on our website that you can find for yourself, but it's a variety of tools we offer. One is our CARE resource guide, the keyword search, that if you're looking to figure out what you can do for certain types of environmental risks or health risks. You can type in a word like asthma or lead and find a whole host of resources that's available to you. Another one is our community's guide to some of our partnership programs that we have out there, like diesel retrofit, waste-wise, those type of things. Another one is our roadmap, which is a process that we have on our web that some of our CARE communities are using to help them through the level one steps. There's also another link on our website for the KCH Environmental Health Tools.
You have reached the recording limit.
And the third one is a guide that we compiled with the help of our federal partners that gives you some additional sources.
I know your party's extension number. You may dial it at any time. We're coming directly.
I don't know who that is, guys. I hope that hangs up soon. Next slide is our CARE map, which shows you out of these 5 years where we are. And we're across the nation, as I said, 68 communities, including Alaska, Hawaii, and the Virgin Islands.
Thank you for calling. Thank you, Mrs. Mayor.
Hello?
I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
We have a lot of trouble. Can someone put... either hang up if you're finding this trouble for us, or put your phone on mute. And to put your phone on mute, you do *6. And the last slide is just our contact that shows you who our CARE coaches are, Pat Carey and Gail Bonanno. Shows you our hotline number and also our website. And so, again, this call is for you to ask your questions to us. Mm-hmm. So Michelle is going to moderate that, and I'm gonna turn this over to Michelle to take care of that for us.
Great, thank you, Marva.
As Marva may have mentioned at the beginning, I'll mention again now, you can submit questions over the internet if you are on computer, and we'll also give you opportunity to ask your questions over the phone. Again, it's the *6 to mute your phone, and it's the #6 to have access again to speaking to us. So we do appreciate you muting your phone while you're not trying to ask the question. I'll be switching between questions submitted over the internet and questions posed over the phone, so everyone will have an opportunity. We had about 200 callers on our last webcast, and we were able to get to all the questions. So we hope to be able to do that again. If it seems like we're not going to be able to, then we'll let you know how we propose to address all the questions at the end of this webcast, because we will be getting to all your questions one way or another. I do want to make sure we give everyone an opportunity to ask a question. Some people do submit multiple questions. We will be giving everyone an opportunity to ask at least one question before we go to second questions from anyone. So if we get multiple questions from you over the computer, we'll just be taking the first one and we'll let the others queue up. Also over the phones, I'll be asking for first-time questioners until we make sure everyone has asked their first question, and then we'll be going back to the phones for folks who have already asked a question. For folks asking questions over the phone, I'll just ask that you say your name and where you're from. And just to reiterate a couple things Marva said, again, we're not going to be able to answer questions about your very specific questions about your project. So just know if you're asking those, we'll probably be reiterating. We won't be able to answer that. And also, we may be referring you again to the question and answer document if there's a good thorough answer there as well. So I don't see at this time any. Well, we have one question over the computer, so I'm going to start there, and then I'm going to go to the phone for our first question. So our first question that we received over the internet is from Anna in Louisiana, and the question is, what are the major differences between the 2009 and the 2010 CARE RFPs?
Hi. I would say there's two major differences. One is we're not submitting on grants.gov this year because of the problems that grants.gov had. So we're actually doing, if you want to electronically to submit, we have a CARE web email system to do that with, and that's in your RFP. And the other major difference is that we have an extra evaluation for a level one. We actually broke out the leveraging, I'm sorry, and for a level two. We actually broke out one of the evaluations, and it was in two. It was leveraging and ability to leverage and sustainability of community effort. So we broke that out into two separate evaluation criteria. Mm. And in your eligibility, one more that's in your eligibility list of to be eligible under Section 3 is that we added a paragraph on ACORN where if you any Congress has prohibited the use of federal funds to award grants to the Association of Community Organizations of Reform Now. So those are the three major differences. The grants.gov is not there. The level two evaluation, one of the evaluation points was broken up into 2 points instead of one. And the eligibility paragraph on ACORN, which you cannot be affiliated with them to get an award.
And I just say, the differences are really probably more minor than major. The RFP is not hugely different than it was last year.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, we'll take a question over the phone.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
I'm Nancy from Virginia.
Yes, go ahead.
In the write-up of the grant, you talk about identifying all the risks. I know you don't mean everything because, as you said, we don't know what the effects of global climate change are, but, I mean, you list five, you know, air quality, drinking water, so on. Well, if your community is dealing with just one major issue and they don't address the others, is that seen as a kind of a not as important then? You know, you know what I mean?
Well,
I mean we have a major emphasis on one pollution aspect that we really want to deal with.
Yeah, well, for care programs, you have to look at more than one major risk. And if you do not, then you're not, care is probably not for you. Because at care level one, we want you to look across your place-based community to look at multiple risks.
Well,
so,
let's say we have three of the five that are listed in that just that overall list. Let's say we have three.
Mm-hmm.
Is that is that fundable?
Well,
that's really my question. Should we bother? You know, should we bother applying for this?
Willingness to look.
Yeah,
I don't know if you can answer
that.
I thought I can answer it.
If you articulate that you are willing to look across your community, and when you looked, you came up with three, if you articulate that, then you're not going to be ineligible, but it's going to be, but you have other factors to see how good your proposal is. So in other words, let me put it this way. If you come into us and say, we're from community X, and we have this problem, we know we have this problem, and this is the only problem we have, then you're not fulfilling the requirements of the care level one.
Uh-huh.
Because the care level one is asking you to step back and look at your risks. And these risks do not have to just be environmental. They can be social, economic risks as well. So we're asking you to do that. And
okay.
Maybe care's not for you if you can't do that.
Right. And if there's already a group, you know, a very strong group that has done level one sort of assessments and inventorying, but outside of that group there aren't partnerships formed, can we apply for level two knowing that we're going to get these other partnerships maybe after March 9th?
Now, a level two, you have to have an established partnership. If you do not have an established partnership, you will not be eligible for a level two. So I would advise you to go back to the section three when
uh-huh.
it talks about you have to be eligible for your threshold eligibility requirement, and it's going to tell you if you don't have an established partnership, do not apply for a level two.
Okay, partnership, I mean, could you define that for me, please? I know I'm going on and on, but I just want to make sure I understand whether we should apply for level one or level two.
Well, for me, a partnership is a multi-diverse set of stakeholders who have come together on a regular basis and hold meetings and talk about what's going on in their community.
And you already have to have had those meetings and established that partnership prior to ever applying for level two then.
Because most of the competitive level twos are also sending us in a copy of their monthly meeting notes.
Okay.
Proving that to us.
Okay, great. Thank you. That was very clear. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the internet for our next question submitted. This is from Christopher in Scottsdale, Arizona. I reviewed the question and answer document for the CARE 2010 proposal. And I have a question, and the answer to the question A5, it states the intent of EPA through this grant is to provide geographic diversity in the CARE project. Salt River, Pima, Maricopa, and new communities located in Scottsdale, Arizona, near the Phoenix metropolitan area, and a level one grant was given to the Intertribal Council of Arizona, Gila River Indian Community. My question is, if a grant has been given to that community for a level one, does this cover the geographic diversity for the Phoenix metropolitan area?
I don't think I think that grant was given a little while ago. So, yeah, I'm looking at it now. It was given in 06. So I don't think that would be a problem for you, since that was almost 4 years ago.
Okay.
It's a consideration, but it's also very much the strength of the proposal that is our first consideration.
And you can see in the RFP, in fact, it even talks about, under the National Selection Committee, what are some of the criteria that we employ. That's geographic diversity is simply one of a number of criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Good to hear.
So we're going to go back to the phone for another first-time questioner. Do we have a question?
Hi, this is Adam, Pennsylvania. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the role of EPA voluntary programs. We've seen some news reports in the recent weeks that EPA may be, de-emphasizing voluntary programs as it re-emphasizes enforcement in some areas. And I'm just wondering how that plays into the role of voluntary programs in the grant proposal.
We look at our voluntary programs a little bit differently. We actually call them partnership programs because they're working in partnership with our communities. And unfortunately, the term voluntary programs was used years ago, so that's why it's still on our document. But they are actually partnership programs of how we work on the ground with our communities. For example, if it's with diesel retrofit or if it's with food for schools that's working in, with asthma concerns. So it's not that, I don't think that's going to affect us what you're hearing in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, CARE is about partnership programs. Voluntary programs is not about regulatory programs. It helps support our regulatory and enforcement efforts in many ways, but it's considered very different.
But I understand your concern because we're mm-hmm. still calling them voluntary programs, and we have to change that language.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for clearing that up.
Okay.
Our next question over the internet comes from Kathleen Freeman in Denton, Maryland. Is the application process, should the applicant identify EPA partnership programs that are relevant, or would EPA identify those potential programs after an application was submitted?
No, when you apply for a CARE grant, you have to tell us which partnership programs you feel could help best work with your project. Of course, if you're awarded a CARE grant, then the regional team that's formed around you will actually help work with you as well to identify other programs within EPA. But you have to articulate to us which of these partnership programs do you think could help assist you with the work you want done.
Okay. So back to the phones. Do we have another question from the phone?
This is Elizabeth from Kansas.
Yeah.
I have a quick question and a subsequent question, depending on how long that is. The most important question, we're submitting a Level 2 application, and we're wanting to conduct several projects. I'm wondering if there's any recommendation in terms of the development of a logic model. I know it's optional, but I'm trying to determine if CARE would prefer to have one logic model for all of the projects or a separate logic model per project.
For your individual project you're asking about?
Correct.
Yes, we would be very interested, I mean, it's not a requirement, but we'd be very interested in having a logic model for a specific project, for specific projects, and have been very interested when projects have had them.
So if we have three projects, then it would be best to have three separate logic models.
Well, that's
your call.
That's up to you.
Right, okay.
I mean,
so you don't have a preference, or CARE doesn't have a preference.
No, AIR doesn't have a stated any stated preference. No.
Yes, because there's like 20 people who are going to review your project. So it's up to you how best you want to submit it and articulate what you're doing. So it's
okay. Thank you.
Think about evaluation criteria.
Submit
that for that reason, and think about how you could best make your case vis-a-vis that evaluation criteria.
And the other question is very quick. I understand the budget needs to be in the SF-424. So is the budget justification supposed to be in the 10 pages rather than the actual budget?
The budget in the 10 pages is where you articulate where your budget items relate to your project description. So the budget in the application is a more in-depth articulation of these amount of dollars are being used to do this that's described in my project description.
Right.
So it's a back and forth more so.
Yeah, and
it has to be more detailed, the budget in the 10 pages.
Yeah, the budget in the SF-424A is really pretty rudimentary, and it's there because that is an official requirement of the grant of process. As much as anything else. The budget in the application is what we will really look at as we start evaluating the project.
Okay, so a little bit about the justification and the budget more in the 10 pages. Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right. So we'll go ahead and take a question from over the Internet now. We have one from Laura in Elkhart, Indiana. This question is, how much of a local match is required?
Yeah, we don't require, Laura, we don't require matches at all.
Okay.
And
then a follow-up question was, would it need to be monetary or can it be in kind? And again, it's not required at all.
Yeah, we don't require matches at all. And if you put in your budget that there is some type of extra there, then we're going to make you adhere to that. So we don't require it. I would suggest you don't list it. We don't require it.
Mm-hmm. And there's no special valuation credit given to matches.
Mm-hmm.
People with matches and without matches are treated the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll take another question from the phone.
Hello. This is Sherry from Boston.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I did send an Internet question with several, but it hasn't come up yet. Thought I'd send it quickly.
Oh, it's the next one, yes. Okay.
Oh, okay. Well, do you want to read them from the Internet?
Okay, I can go ahead. Sure. This is from Sherry in Boston, and it is, what is the regional distribution for awards this year? If there is a group of – oh, okay, there are several. Okay, so regional distribution of awards for this year.
It's basically the best project. I mean, we are awarding to the best project, so there's not so much of a regional distribution. However, this year we hope to award 10 projects, and we have 10 regions. But we are actually just looking at the best project for the CARE money.
There isn't a quota, but remember that geographic diversity criteria that we try to employ.
Mm-hmm. A follow-up question, if there is a group of partners, who's the applicant? Anyone you select, Sherry?
There's one applicant.
That is the person with
the fiduciary responsibility,
mm-hmm.
The reporting responsibility, and the like. There cannot be multiple applicants.
And it's the one who submits the grant to us.
The name on the form.
Yeah.
So can funds go to more than one organization?
That's up to you and your budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there you can have sub-awards. Or subcontracts, that's up to you and your budget.
We have examples where people have done that. Again, this points out the value of looking at, on the website, there is a listing of all 66 communities and their projects.
You can sort through there,
and I'll just give you a heads up. Rochester, New York project did just that.
We don't have any cap on the number of partners. That was your last questionnaire, I believe. We don't have a cap on the number of partners who can receive funds. However, there is rules and policies in place that you have to adhere to if you're going to sub-grant or sub-award to someone. So you have to adhere to those rules and policies in place.
And there's quite a few questions on that in the question and answer document.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sherry, we advise you to go on the WebCare website, look at our question and answer document, and just read through it. I think that will help you with some of your questions.
Okay. Thank you. I'll just say thank you. I haven't had the chance to look at all the documents online, so I appreciate that.
If you don't do anything else, Sherry, look at that Q&A document, because some of your questions, your responses are right there that we just said.
I think it will help you, too, with whether they're how fund are used.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so maybe I'll take another question over the phone because that kind of covered our next Internet question as well. Is there another question over the phone?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi. This is Marion from New York. I just had a question about level one. Is there any room in level one to actually start to do some intervention, or is it really only about creating the partnership and having those discussions and coming out with priorities and all that.
Yes, we pride ourselves on saying at level one, we call this a bias for action. So at the same time you're looking across your community, you something could rise up as an urgent need to start doing some intervention. And we pride ourselves, a number of our level ones have done just that.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. So our next question over the internet is from Jesse Lyons in Syracuse, New York. What type and extent of assessment, environmental and socioeconomic, needs to be completed for prior, I guess, to applying for level two?
Well, to apply for level two, you have to have done your assessment early on in the level one phase, or at least through another program or set of programs that you've done some type of assessment. And we actually do describe it a little bit in our RFP under section one in our descriptive comments. Numbers 5 and 6 talk about what does it mean for communities to gain an understanding of all the major pollutant potential sources of exposure to toxic pollutants and environmental concerns, and how do you set priorities for those activities? So I would suggest you go back and read at least those two, three paragraphs, and it gives you a discussion on what we mean by doing an assessment or an understanding of all the risks. And then before you apply for a level two.
And also look at the roadmap document. Earlier in Marva's presentation, she alludes to that. It's on the publications page, which is on the left side of the main web page. I think that's a real hands-on guide that can help you and demystify some of this.
It's only about 10 pages long, and you can hit the high points and get a sense of what we're looking for. We'll take a question over the phone now. Anyone who has not yet posed a question? Okay. We'll turn. Was someone trying to ask a question there?
I have a question. This is Phil from California. Is there a focus on contaminated sites? I mean, are we looking for communities that have identified contaminated sites? I see how it's tied into the CLUIN network, and I don't know if that's an area of focus for you or if it isn't.
No. This is just what we're using for our webcast.
Right.
There is not a particular focus on contaminated sites, so we do deliver some brownfield funding through.
Yeah, you have to be careful. You have to be careful when you articulate a project for us, because CARE is we have a variety of strategies that we are funded under, and we cannot be funded under like RCRA or Superfund. And we can't be funded on the brownfield, so you have to be very careful when you articulate your project that it's a broad-based project across the community. And so most of our communities have contaminated sites.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that, but it's more than just a contaminated site. And so we cannot fund a Superfund project, or we cannot fund a brownfield project. That's why we work in partnership with those programs and are able to, once you're awarded, we're able to work with you and hopefully get you some guidance from those particular programs to help you with those contaminated sites in your project.
But there's no special attention given to contaminated sites.
And they can't write it as a contaminated site project.
Yeah, more importantly, remember, and harking back to what we mentioned earlier, we're interested in you looking broadly at the air, water, land issues and not immediately focusing upon one thing. That's what makes CARE different than so many of the other grant opportunities, this broad-based, holistic approach that we think fits with communities and we're trying to put in place.
And specifically in the RFP, under Section 1, it talks about Section 1D, Supplementary Information, Number 2, Statutory Authorities for CARE Awards. It talks about what care cooperative agreements cannot be used for. And in that list, it tells you, do not use it for Superfund, do not use it for brownfields. You know, so it tells you that. Do not use it for diesel retrofit technology. So it tells you that. So you need to make sure you read your RFP very carefully. Because if you write it from that perspective, you will not be eligible for care.
Okay. We'll take our next question from the Internet. This is from Beryl in Staten Island, New York. Beryl states that the organization in question has identified 21 sites that have contamination problems from post-industrial use. Our waterfront communities were also chosen by the EPA as an environmental justice showcase community. We have identified sites in our EJ booklet, but we need technical support and help developing partnerships with local waterfront businesses. We fall somewhere between level one and two. Which application should we apply for?
Well, first of all, you've identified 21 sites for contamination problems. If that was your only way of doing a thorough look at your community, that's not enough for us. We need you to look at broadly across your neighborhood. So just looking at contamination sites is not enough for us. So you have to go back and look at that to see how you look across your community. That will not make you eligible, just looking at 21 contamination sites. So again, I refer you back to where I asked, told the gentleman earlier, or lady, I can't remember who it was, but under Section 1, Section 1B of her scope of care project, in the descriptions 5 and 6, it talks about what you have to do to look at across your community to understand all your major potential sources of exposure and what you have to do to set up your prioritization for your risk reduction activities. If you don't do that, then you cannot apply for a level 2.
Yes, it's a very competitive grants program. If there's any question that you're between the two, it's definitely level 1.
And again, look at the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
We put the evaluation criteria in there so that you can do a self-assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what criteria you're going to be judged by.
And again, we love the CARE program, but it's not for everybody. And so if you don't think that you're an exact fit, then, you know, you might want to relook at that
mm-hmm.
for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go back to the phone and see if we have a first-time questioner. Okay.
First-time questioner here?
Yeah.
Hello. Okay, this is Dan. I'm calling from Bedford Stuyvesant in Brooklyn.
Yes, Dan.
Okay, and I want to invite the CARE team to the Magnolia Tree Earth Center after we receive our award.
Thank you.
I'm thinking positive. I'm quite concerned about, one, we're just receiving notice about this program, so we have a lot of work to do with all of the board changes occurring at EPA. I'm hoping that maybe in the next fiscal year there'll be $20 million instead of two so that you can increase the number of awards. Towards that end, I note that we're looking at a level one, and I see you're looking at awarding 1 to 3 awards, and I understood that there were probably 200 people on the call. If you could maybe give some more focus on what distinguishes a selected versus non-selected candidate.
The strength of a level one is that you do not have to have a partnership in place, but it really, I think it really strengthens your application if you have been working with some stakeholders already, and even if you're just pulling it together for this level one, it shows your history of working with these stakeholders in a multi-diverse group of people. So that really helps.
Okay.
That you have some. It just didn't happen two months ago that you're pulling this together, that these are people you've been working with for a while. So that's the strength that I see, because it's very competitive. Another strength is that you are articulating a process for us
mm-hmm.
of how you're looking across, broadly across your community. It's not just you're pulling together things that other people have done, but you're articulating this process. And this is how you're going to look across your community, and this is how you're going to identify not only environmental problems, but also socioeconomic problems that affect your community, and how are you going to engage that various stakeholders in that process when you talk about reaching consensus around what you're going to look at, which ones you want to address when you become a level two. Also, I think, because I sit with the selection panel, I think it really helps us to see how you have engaged that affected community. And if they are engaged, and how you are engaging a lot of the stakeholders who live and work in that community. And then I think a plus is your budget. And you articulate to us how you're going to use that $90,000 to $100,000 to make sure that that work gets done in your community. Michelle sits on the question panel too. I'm gonna see if she has anything.
Yeah, all those
to
things,
add.
And just I was even just gonna lead with just a clearly articulated work plan, and just a well thought out work plan really stands out, because we know a lot of folks don't. It's a difficult thing, grant writing, and you all are very busy people, and shows when it's a clearly well thought out and articulated. Work plan and application.
All right.
Well, hopefully thank you very happens. Much.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very much so.
Okay. So we'll go back to the internet, and we have Kathy in Fairbanks, Alaska. Can CARE be used or set up to help communities that have been identified by the EPA as non-attainment areas due to their air quality?
Well, sure. Actually, that's part of the whole regulatory milieu of the AIR program. But that's, again, just part of the picture. That's addressing air issues. It doesn't really address water issues. It doesn't address land issues. And remember, once again, you need to consider all of those. So just saying we're a non-attainment area doesn't necessarily give you a leg up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
there are so many non-attainment areas.
We'll turn back to the phone. Are there any first-time questioners?
Hi, this is Katie in Pennsylvania. I have a question about Level 1 projects. In the RFP, you seem to say that you'd rather have qualitative assessment of risks rather than quantitative. But some of the examples given, like looking at routes of exposure and estimating cumulative impacts, seem to be more quantitative in nature. So I'm wondering if you could give any guidance or examples about methods of assessment that you consider appropriate for Level 1.
Well, some of the quantitative and the qualitative is probably going to be, especially the quantitative will be more so in the Level 2. But there is other measures that you can use for a Level 1. Some of our measures are just the fact that you have brought together this multi-diverse stakeholder, and they are reaching consensus on a number of things, and they're working together.
It may be that we just want to err on the side. We were just trying to emphasize erring on the side of communicating throughout the community.
Well, and I think this is important. One, $100,000. If you get into the risk assessment world,
right,
is not very much money. We don't want you to spend all of your money simply doing a risk assessment.
Yeah.
We think also there is a lot of information out there that typically is untapped or underutilized. And we're actually urging communities to turn to that. And thirdly, as a strategy that many communities have employed, is that when they turn to put together their partners, they look for partners that have a lot of acumen when it comes to these sorts of assessments and can bring both information and technical expertise to the table. We find that very often communities tap into local universities as a rich source of that technical expertise. So that's really what we're getting at, and why we think and have the language in there to not lead you down the path of developing a risk assessment.
Yeah.
but to do something that is faster, better, and cheaper, quite frankly, and fits into the CARE model of being holistic and broad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you got a chance to look at Appendix A as part of RFP, which gives you some examples. Is that not a different question? Oh, okay.
Thanks, Marva.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll turn back to the internet, and we have a question from Reed in Kentucky. How developed do community partnerships for Level 1 partnerships have to be?
Well, first of all, the CARE RFP tells you that you can develop your partnership under a CARE Level 1. Basically, you can develop it on a CARE Level 1. I think I answered the question of a gentleman who asked me a frank question about what I see as a tip for Level 1s that we see who are getting these awards. And I think I did say that what we are seeing is that the ones that are getting the awards are ones who have already been working with a number of stakeholders before they pulled together this partnership. So that history of working with stakeholders are important. You do not have to have a formed partnership to apply for Level 1. You can do that as part of the Level 1 process.
And the follow-up question, I'm not sure, Marva, if you addressed it in what you said earlier, but are Second Circuit organizations permitted to affiliate with ACORN since that court has enjoined Congress's attempt to ban affiliation with ACORN?
Well, I'm not an attorney at all. But in your CARE RFP, it does tell you under Section 3, Eligibility Information, B, number 10, that it has a whole paragraph on ACORN that you should read. And it talks about, and so it's in your RFP, so we have to adhere to what's already in the RFP. And if that says that in the RFP, regardless of the court cases, I would suggest you to adhere to that. Again, I'm not an attorney. If it comes that, you know, we need some legal advice on that, we will get it. Frank, do I need to say anything more than that? Or?
No, I think you're accurate. Our general counsel has required us to put that prohibition in there, and until they tell us otherwise, it needs to remain. And since we're making these decisions here in headquarters, we're not part of the Second Circuit, so we're going to abide by what our circuit has right now until its council advises us otherwise.
Okay. So we'll go back to the phone. Do we have any questions from the phone?
Hello, my name is... Yes. My name's Rachel Bliss, and I did a environmental justice grant with EPA Small Communities. I was wondering if you could distinguish, I know the money's more with this grant, but could you name some other distinguishing differences, or am I asking wrong people?
No, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. I mean, I can just tell you that we've had a number of environmental justice small grants who have branched out and became CARE Level 1, and they've used their environmental justice grant as a way to start forming their partnership. And,
so it's kind of like a step process almost.
Right. I've seen that, but how many EJ grants, environmental justice grants, there's probably thousands of them, but I don't know what all of them do, but I do know that we've had a number of successful CARE Level 1s who have done environmental justice small grants before they applied. So.
I'm kind of focused on cross-media or multimedia, I think, is perhaps one thing that sets CARE a little bit apart from EJ. We have much more of an emphasis and focus on that.
Dennis is correct. We do look at, the CARE does look at more of a broader range of media, environmental media. Margaret, was that you trying to
get it? Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Some key differences are under the EJ small grants. It's multimedia, but basically you're not required to have a broad-based partnership. You are implementing a project that meets two or more statutes, but it's project-based. So, for example, in Care Level 1, you're building a broad-based multi-stakeholder partnership that includes business, EJ Grassroots, and state and local government. Also, in Care Level 1, for example, you're looking at cumulative, all of the environmental health issues, and you're collecting data, analyzing it, and doing a risk screening and prioritization on it. And Level 2, you already have a broad-based multi-stakeholder group. You've already gone through a Level 1 type process where the community has identified the priorities, and you're taking action. So EJ Small Grants give you experience. You develop capacity. They're multimedia, but they're more small project focused.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, why don't you identify who you are?
Go ahead, Margaret.
I'm Margaret Millard. I'm the Region 5 Care Program Manager, and I also am the Program Manager for all environmental justice grants in Region 5.
Well, thank you.
And just so some of you may know that when you are, if you are fortunate enough to be selected to be looked at by the selection panel, we have a regional representative on the selection panel from all 10 of our regions, and there are people like Margaret Millard who have a host of experience and a lot of some programs, not just environmental justice, who come to the selection panel to look at your application. Thanks, Margaret.
So going back to the internet, we have a question from Sarah in Wyoming. And the question is, can only one threat be addressed through a level two, provided it has been established as a priority in the community? I guess, can you have just a single focus level two, I think is the question.
You can have a single focus level two, but we still, to be competitive, We also place higher emphasis on more than one focus.
Can have a single focus level two, but we still to be competitive.
Okay.
So we'll go back to the phone, and I think two people were trying to ask a question at once in that last time on the phone. So if the person who wasn't able to ask their question wanted to ask it now, I ask that other people hold their questions.
Yes, my name is Yibing Li. I'm calling from Warsaw, Illinois, at Chicago. I have a question on the RFP page 26.
Okay.
Use our funds to make subaward to a care contract service. So we are apply for level one program. And we have a community partner in the grant, in the application, and we named the organization. However, if you continue reading on the second paragraph under that item D, in the middle of that paragraph said applicants must compete contract for services and products. So even we named them as a partner on the program, eventually they have to go through RFP to let other party compete for this contract for service?
Well, it's not exactly like an RFP. I mean, they have to, well, I'll let Frank answer, but you don't have to put out an RFP for that. You just have to get married one day. Is that correct, Frank? And I'll let Frank answer. He's from the grants office.
Yeah, essentially what we're looking at is probably two different things. One is a partner where you have a sub-grant type relationship where they're working with you on the main mission of the project.
Yes.
The other would be a contract where the contractor is doing something specific to further your project or provide a specific service for your project. And the contracts are the things that would have to be competed based on your organization's own rules. So, for example, I can't think of some things you guys might do, but it might be, say you wanted to test water samples and you needed somebody to do that, a lab to do that, you might compete a contract to find a lab to do that. However, if it's something more broad-based and they're an actual partner working with you on this, it can be a sub-award, a sub-grant, that does not have to be competed, where you set that up as you prepare the application.
Okay.
And so we also would like to refer you to our Q&A question and answer document. And we have a section that's labeled E, and it's question E4 that outlines the entire subaward policy for EPA that you can read. That gives you a little bit more detail to that. All right?
Okay. Thank you.
Great. I'll turn back to the internet, and we have a question from Will in Greenville, Tennessee. Is the amount of work with minority groups taken into consideration for receiving the grant? And the answer is no. Okay. So I'll turn back to the phone and see if we have someone with a question they would like to pose who's asking a question for the first time.
A question. We have several different documents that, you know.
Could you say your name and where you're from?
Okay, I'm Lily Kay. I'm with Upper Guyanot Watershed Association in Mullins, West Virginia.
Great, thank you.
We have done many different assessments. We have a brownfield assessment. We have a watershed-based plan. We have an Army Corps of Engineer document with flooding mitigation and air quality data. Is it possible to do a level two having done all of those kind of assessments already?
Well, level two is not just the assessments. It's also the collaboration with your community groups.
Right. Well, we are a community-based group that have, you know, I mean, we're all throughout the watershed and regionally. We have partners.
Okay. Then I would refer you to the RFP, and it's under Section 3. It's under Section 3, and it's under B, Threshold Eligibility Requirement. And it talks about, when it talks about the eligibility, to be eligible for a level two project agreement, it actually talks about, and I'll read this for you, and so I have to refer you back to the RFP because we have to go with what's in the RFP.
Well, yeah, and I've read that. It's just confusing to me.
Okay, well, it says it is not acceptable to have a process in which several different unrelated groups did separate analysis of different risks, and then the applicant takes the results from the separate groups and simply puts them together. And let me just read the second sentence. Somewhere in this process, there must be a single broad-based stakeholder group that will examine all these environmental risks and impacts across media and come to a community-based consensus on the priority. So it's not the fact that you have separate analytical processes. You can do that. You can pull them together, but you've got to reach a community-based consensus as a group. And I don't know if you've done that. And you may have. And if you've done that with all these different processes, then just articulate that, and that would be fine. But if you haven't done that, you have to do that to be a level, to be a competitive level two. You've had to come together as a community and say, we looked at these five different assessments as a community, and we have reached consensus that we want to address these first four as over the other ones. So you have to do that as a community group, community-based partnership. Now, you may have done that, and so I'm not saying you have not, but you've got to let us know you've done that.
Okay.
And
all right.
Page 34, number 3 in the evaluation criteria of that gives you an idea too about what we expect.
Okay, I mean we have done surveys and things like that, and like I said, our organization is community based and have brought together all of the environmental pollutants and discussed them and come up with a consensus on it. So, I mean, I feel that we're ready for a level two. I just wanted to make sure.
It's just important to definitely clearly articulate that because we'll be looking for that in the narrative.
Right.
Okay. All right, cool, thanks.
And just so everybody on this call understands, we always go back to the RFP. That's why you really need to read it, because when we make our decisions, we go back to make sure you've done exactly what we've asked you to do.
Okay, I'm going to turn back to another question from the internet. Cindy in Hastings, Nebraska, who I think I haven't taken a question from yet. Okay, so can you talk about the usual and allowable expenses for level one? Can we ask for a percentage of our overhead costs without having a negotiated indirect cost rate, and does the supplanting rule apply for this grant?
Okay. Can you do that, Frank, or do you want me to do it? Because we do have some things in our Q&A.
Yeah, you can talk about your usual and allowable expenses, because that's more a programmatic call than the other two.
Okay, well, we do have stuff in the RFP for that. Let me answer the second question first, because the second question is a lot easier, and I'll ask Dennis to start looking for that. So the second question was about,
I think it's a no. Can we ask for a percentage of our overhead costs without having a negotiated indirect cost rate?
No, yeah. You have to have a negotiated indirect cost rate, or you have to articulate direct costs in your budget.
And what about the supplanting rule? Does that apply for this grant? I'm not even sure what that is.
I'm not familiar with that term.
Do we need to follow up?
We can follow up about the supplanting rule, because I'm not familiar with that either. I don't know what supplanting rule is.
This is Margaret. Could I just add one thing to the question?
Sure.
Which is, if you don't have a federally approved indirect cost rate, but you intend to apply for one with this grant, you can get a term and condition so that you would have to submit an application for an indirect cost rate within 90 days. If you know that's something you want to do with this grant, you can include indirect costs in your application, and then we'll work with you to develop an indirect cost rate, and we'll special condition that into your grant award. But you will only have 90 days to get that application complete, and also you cannot charge any indirect costs until you have an approved indirect cost rate.
Thank you, Margaret, for that clarification.
And I would add that in the question and answer document, section D, cost of funding, it also talks about that, as well as some other things related to that. And when we go back into allowable costs, I'm just going to look at the sample budget that's in there for us. And everything in that sample budget that we have for you, which is an example, is allowable. I mean, your travel costs, your supplies, things for printing or postage. I mean, meeting, things you have to do to get ready for your meeting, all those are allowable costs. So, I mean, I don't really know exactly what you're asking, but when you are awarded the grant, then you will work very closely with your regional project officer, and they will line by line tell you what is not allowed.
And I think we've mentioned what is not fundable in the RFP.
Right. I mean, things like alcohol, interest on loans, things like that are very obvious, not allowed. Are the cost principles that OMB has out? They're in 2 CFR, and I believe it's parts 220 and 225, depending which kind of recipient you are. Those are the basic requirements for what determines its allowability. And programs can be a little bit more stringent than that as well.
And again, I would just refer you to the section D of the Q&A, because it also gives you a link to those OMB documents as well.
Okay, so turning back to the phone, do we have a question from someone who has not yet posed a question? Okay. Well, we still have a number on the internet, so I'll continue to go through maybe a few of these, and then I'll turn back to the phones. So this one is from Marilyn in Washington State. The Tribes Partnership Group has identified the number one problem for the reservation community, and it is illegal dumps opened up site, and while there are several steps to address the problem, and the tribes do have an integrated solid waste management plan, we would like to address storage reduction through a Level 2 application. And the basic question is this a good idea? So this is one of those questions that we're going to have to say we can't comment specifically on whether...
But we can say this. I mean, you're looking to apply for a Level 2, and you're saying that you've already identified the number one problem. You have to make sure you completely articulate how you came up with that identification
you
process.
You did start out looking at all media, and out of that exercise came as what you want to tackle.
Because if you just tell us the tribe partnership says that this is the number one problem and don't give us any background to how you reached that number one problem and how you reached consensus that that was the number one problem, then it's not good enough for a Level 2.
Mm-hmm. So, great. Okay. So I'll go ahead and take another one off the Internet. This is from Anjali in San Francisco, California. We have many community partners who are part of citywide collaboratives and other community organizations. For Level 1, what will be a strong demonstration of support by a broad range of the community? We have many letters of support already from community members who are excited about engaging in the proposed project. How many letters do we need, and do we need one from each partner we list in the partnership section? This is for a Level 1.
You don't need... a ton of letters. You do need letters that say they not only support the partnership, but this is what they will do to help the partnership in the project for whatever the project description you have. And you do need to make sure it's a multi-diverse group, so you don't have like tons of letters all from academia and none from another section of the realm. And so when you ask the question for Level 1, would that be a strong demonstration of a support by a broad range of community? Well, I mean, I guess I need to know what's your community partnership. You know, I mean, maybe that is your basis for a community partnership, and which is strong, but you have to articulate what's your community partnership. Are you pulling together this, all these citywide collaboratives? And so it depends upon how you write it up, I would say.
And be sensitive to this sense of community. Saying that all of San Francisco is a community seems on the face of it perhaps a little too big. We talk a little bit in our RFP about size as being important. We don't have specific hard definition of what's too big, too small, but a whole city is usually not what we're looking at for a CARE grant, as opposed to portions or certain communities within the overall city.
Yeah, because don't forget, we're looking to build local community collaboration, and we feel that if it's local, then it has to be small enough where you can get together on a regular basis and talk about what's going on in those neighborhoods. So we don't award the whole city of New York City, for example, as a CARE grant. We award a portion of it, the west side of New York or the west side of Chicago. So you have to be very careful, like Dennis says, about what your definition of community is. And again, in the RFP in Section 1, under B, 3, it talks about definition of community under the CARE program.
Okay. I'm going to turn back to the phone and just see if we have a first-time questioner at this time. Okay. Well, then I'll look back to the Internet. We have a question from Julia Taylor in New Jersey. This is a specific question about the wording in the RFP. On page 23, section 4C3, the fourth bullet, under narrative proposal format, says that pages must be numbered in order starting with the project title and continuing through key personnel sections. Does this mean that each required section of the narrative proposal must be on its own page, or that each required section must be identified by the number associated with it in the RFP?
It does not have to be on its own page. It has to be identified with a number. You only have 10 pages, so we know that you're going to have certain sections on together on the same page. We want you to be as articulate as, I guess, concise as you can be. So we don't, with only 10 pages, there's no way you could put everything on as a separate page.
In a nutshell, it means that if we drop this and the pages all fall on the floor, we can put it back together again and successfully read your proposal. It's no more than that. It's just making sure all the pages are numbered in consecutive order.
Yeah, but she's also talking about the sections.
Do they need to be numbered as well?
They just need to be identified so that we know that this is your organizational overview and this is your community. I mean, that's a good grant writer. Let us know that we're asking for certain things, and this is the paragraph or whatever you have it under. That helps, makes it easier for us to read your work plan. You want to make it as easy as possible because there's a number of people reading your work plan, so you don't want them to have to hunt for things.
Now, what about a follow-up question? Does the narrative proposal need to be address the required sections in the order they're presented in the RFP?
I think the only order that has to be addressed is the evaluation order of your evaluation criteria. That should be in order.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as we don't have to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
If you want us to hunt for it, then you're going to lose engagement of folks reading your work plan. So I suggest you try to make it as easy as you can for us, so we don't have to look for what you're supposed to be writing about.
Absolutely. Just use good sense. This is about your attempt to make as good a case as you can for your community to people who will have to read an awful lot of these.
Mm-hmm.
So the better and more straightforward you can make it, the better it's going to be.
And your last question is about the budget, and rather it has to be part of the 10-page narrative proposal. Yes, it does. Now, you do not have to have a 2-page budget. You could have a 1-page budget, but it's got to be part of that 10-page narrative proposal.
Okay. Great. I'll go ahead and just address, take another one from the Internet. This one is from Claudia in Portland, Oregon. Do you require a bibliography, and is it considered an attachment?
No, we don't require a bibliography, and I would definitely not put it as part of my 10 pages if I was writing it. You can do what you want,
mm-hmm.
but I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Some people do cite their sources of their data that they're referencing, but we don't require any sort of bibliography. If you want to include one, you could certainly do it as an attachment.
And let's remind people, there's an unlimited number of attachments for level one. For level two, you get 5 attachments, and they can, in total, be no more than 50 pages.
I can't emphasize this enough. A number of people will be reading your work plan, and they're only going to be reading 10 pages, basically. And so you've got to be careful that you don't give them a whole lot of extra stuff that's going to waste your page limit, and it's going to waste their time. Because they're going to be looking for what's required in the narrative proposal and the evaluation criteria.
Mm-hmm. The next one is from Jane in California. On page 24, this is also about on page 24, when it talks about the page numbering through key personnel. Does this mean that the subsequent questions are not included in the 10-page limit? Or just that they do not need to be numbered, everything after key personnel?
Numbered. Okay, everything has to be within the 10-page limit. I believe some of the subsequent questions are covered in your evaluation criteria. So you can be, like we said, concise with that. Make sure you answered your evaluation criteria. I hope you guys have seen that. That's in Section 5. You know, there's a certain separate evaluation criteria for level ones and level twos. So some of that, that's after key personnel, don't forget you got to put the budget in that 10-page as well, but it talks about the environmental results, and it talks about past performance. So some of that is covered in your evaluation criteria. You know, it's covered in, you know, number one, extent of your concerns. Environmental results is on a level one is number five in your evaluation criteria. So it's just giving you some more information that is actually covered on your evaluation criteria. You do know that you have to address these evaluation criteria, or you will not get the points you need to be awarded a project.
And do the evaluation criteria need to be numbered, Marva?
They have to identify which ones they're speaking about.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, they do. But I think what she's saying, I'm assuming, maybe I'm reading her wrong, but this is also talked about under the narrative proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it correlates to the evaluation criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Programmatic capability, that's a whole environment. That's number six under evaluation criteria, number six for level one.
Okay.
So make sure you look at the evaluation criteria and correlate those.
I'm going to take one more question and then go to the phone. This is from Bernadine in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. What is the timeline for awarding a grant if successful?
We usually award the grant by the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. If not by September 30th, it's usually awarded sometime in October.
All right. So turning back to the phone, is there anyone who has not yet asked a question who has a question? Okay. I then have a question here from...
Can we ask another question?
Excuse me? Oh, you have a question. Great. Hey. Please go ahead.
Yes, I do. This is Dan again from Bedford-Stuyvesant, Magnolia Tree. I'm looking at, under the RFP, I'm interested in some guidance on the nonprofit administrative capability assessment. It says that are subject to a pre-award administrative capability review. And it does give the link there, but I was wondering if someone could just very briefly give an overview of what that assessment, capability assessment, would look at. I think that's page 39, on page 39.
Well, this is Margaret in Region 5, and basically what these pre-award compliance reviews look at is, do you meet all of the requirements for nonprofits, which is listed on EPA's website, www.epa.gov/O, like Oliver, G like grants, and D like dog. And basically there are things like, do you have an established training plan that meets all the requirements? Do you have established travel procedures that meet all the requirements? All the requirements for nonprofits are on that website. So
okay. You
could look at that in advance and assess that for yourself. And usually those pre-award compliance reviews are turned around really quickly, usually within 48 hours.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I assume you see that link in the RFP.
Yes, I do see the link, and actually this is an excellent RFP. And again, I apologize because perhaps like others on the line and on the internet, I'm just learning of this particular RFP, but it is an excellent RFP. And I am enjoying the feedback from others on the phone. So I'll be silent now and listen to others.
Okay. This is the next question is from Christy in Maine. Do you have a specific definition of toxic that you ask grant applicants to work with? For example, would moisture evaluations be considered within the realm of toxic, particularly for those with asthma or other at-risk populations? Dennis, did you want to?
Well, I think we specifically have a broad definition of toxics. We wanted to do that so that we could tap into the creativity the communities have, as well as we've thrown the net quite broadly so that toxics in the water media are considered different than toxics in the air media sometimes. What you're talking about really is a precursor to mold, which is an asthma issue. And I think that would be considered a toxic issue. But remember,
certainly a strategy for addressing toxics.
You can't build your application around one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And level one applications in particular, we ask you to look at a broad range. And out of that, the community starts setting priorities and determining what they would like to tackle.
And then I would add to what Dennis was saying, that in your question and answer document that's on the CARE website, which is an excellent document, so you really need to read it, section F is CARE definitions. And it has definitions about what we mean by toxic pollutants and environmental concerns. And it has, definitions about, things that people have already asked about where it relates to community. So I would say, and it has definition about what do we mean by risk. And so I would advise you to just click on that and look at Section F and look at those definitions.
And I'll give you another piece of advice. Take a look at what successful applicants have put in their applications, which are all on the website, to see what kinds of toxics other communities are seeking to address. And I think you'll find out that a wide variety and a lot of creativity.
Okay. A question from Ted in Boston. He's interested in knowing more about the partnership we want between CARE or EPA and the community or project. Is it necessary to decide up front what resources we will use or they will use? If we have a resource that is similar but we think it's not the same as EPA's or we don't know about, can we propose our own? Would you suggest in the review process?
I don't understand.
What we use or offering. I think it means do we need to use what EPA is offering or can we use our own resources? We certainly have grantees who...
You mean the partnership program resources? Or,
yeah.
Oh,
we certainly have grantees who decide their own strategies, who use their own strategies and choose to use them. And that is fine. This is in some ways about innovation and grantees are spreading, lessons between each other about the best ways to address issues. EPA at the national level doesn't have all the answers, certainly, and in some ways we can bring resources to the table that will help a local level strategy, so it's absolutely about collaboration and we're at the table as a partner, but we are not forcing anyone to use only the resources that EPA has to offer.
Exactly, especially when it comes to our university grantees. They have a wealth of resources available at their own university that they put in play with the community partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to our local public health grantees. They have a lot of local programs, cities, county, state programs that they use in place of EPA programs. So yes, we're not saying you've got to use EPA's resources. We're saying they're available to you.
And it's when you put together your partnerships, these are things to consider and what partners bring to the table to really help you carry out your project. That's an important strategic decision.
But it's good for you to articulate that because, while we're reading this, we're going to say, well, how come they're talking about asthma? How come they didn't use some of our, asthma-type programs that they could use? If you articulate that you're talking about asthma and you're using a local program and this is how you're using it, then that will stop our questioning your proposal at our evaluation level.
Our next question is from Jane in Ohio. If we become the project manager and fiscal agent in a CARE collaboration, does the fact that we are already a 40-partner stakeholder group working on water quality count against us? How do we make it clear that we are acting as conveners of a broad multi-issue project rather than the water issue?
You just state that, Jane. I mean, you tell, this, your history is that you are a watershed stakeholder group, but this particular project you're going to be working on as a broader multi-issue purpose. You just take that. You just articulate that, and you make sure we believe it.
Yeah.
And I'd steer clear of using the term fiscal agent because that raises lots of red flags in the grant office. I don't want to say we don't take too kindly to it, but we want to see that you're actually doing work as a recipient, not just shepherding money from one pocket to another.
I have sort of a related question. I've been under a fiscal sponsorship and I'm applying for my 501c3 letter of determination right now. Can I apply without that, or could it be granted under condition of receipt?
If you've got the application ongoing, I think we can condition it.
All right.
As long as you're not 501c4,
right,
it should be okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
And actually, we covered that in the Q&A document.
Should you tell us that in some way that you
Section A.
Yes. Should state that he's working towards it.
So you need to make sure that you articulate that to us, that you are working towards the 501c3 as well, because if you don't, then we're going to assume you don't have it.
And, you know, if you meet the nonprofit definition under OMB Circular A-122, that's what we take as an indication that you are indeed a nonprofit, even if you don't have the 501c3.
Yeah, but please do indicate that you've applied for it and are working to get it.
Okay. The next question is from Carolyn in Montana. Do larger communities receive higher priority than small rural communities? No.
Definitely not.
Look at our map. In fact, you'll see that there's an incredible variety of communities, from very small ones to larger ones, across the United States.
Okay.
Hello. Can I be heard? This is Sherry from Boston again.
Certainly.
Hello. Just for this clarification, and I'm sorry, but this is my earlier question and then these later ones. So if there's a collaborative, an existing collaborative organization made up of numbers of nonprofits, but they operate under an existing collaborative, is it that the applicant needs to be one of the participating nonprofits, not the collaborative, because the collaborative itself is not a 501c3? So it would have to be one of the participating members of the collaborative?
The applicant has to be a nonprofit. You have to make sure that the collaborative is the entity that is driving or the project. And you have to articulate that. We only can award to one applicant, so we can't award to the collaborative.
Uh-huh.
So the applicant we award to is to the nonprofit applicant.
Uh-huh.
In your write-up, you're talking about your collaborative and what your collaborative is doing or is going to.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And I see, Sherry, that you had also submitted another question. Can you give more examples of implementation activities for Level 2 grantees? And for that, we would refer you to the website, and there are descriptions of there are final reports for our earlier grantees, and there are also descriptions of all of our communities and broken out by Level 1 and Level 2.
That's a great wealth of information that I think everybody on the phone really ought to look at. Those are people who had successful proposals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We still have first-time questioners here on the Internet that we haven't gotten to. So this question is from Holly in Indiana. For a Level 2 project, is it advantageous to have a project that is unique to a community but has widespread applicability once developed by using 2010, 2011 funds, widespread applicability when reproduced through the rest of the U.S.? Why or why not?
It's not as advantageous. I mean, if you feel that it does, it won't hurt you to put that in the application, but...
That is not anything in our criteria.
It's not a goal for care. In fact, again, if you look at the variety of projects, I think you're taken aback by they're all so very, very different from one another because they represent local concerns, local issues,
and local organizations. But CARE is not meant to be a pilot program per se for a larger national effort.
Mm-hmm.
We do hope that you'll learn from each other, though, and we think there are many good practices that communities have put in place and other communities can pick up on.
Mm-hmm. The next question is from Shannon in Atlanta, Georgia. What are standout characteristics of a Level 2 proposal? Yeah, basically, I guess reading the previously funded Level 2s on our website would be a good idea, and then obviously they have successfully completed the Level 1 process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
always a standout.
Yeah, I mean, there's a host of them. I mean, I just...
we just don't have...
You have a... You have very good ones right in Georgia. You have a Savannah project in Georgia that's a Level 2. Look at that project. Call the awardee. I'm sure she'd talk to you to let you know what stands out for her project.
Mm-hmm. A strong Level 1 process, I'd say, is a standout for a Level 2.
And that particular person did a strong Level 1 process in Savannah.
So we have a question from Sandra in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was stated earlier that if a state does not have or has never had a CARE grantee, they would be looked at more closely. What does that mean exactly? Thank you.
Well, basically what it means is that you have to write a good work plan. We've had projects from Mississippi. They just have not been written in a way that they made it to the national selection panel. So it's not just because you're from Mississippi. It has to be a good project written up that can pass the CARE test for us.
The geographic diversity, I think, is one of the last criteria.
Right. It's only after you have a good proposal.
It's only after, yes, you pass a number of other rigorous criteria. Okay, let's see if we have any other down here. First time questioners, it looks like we do. Okay.
Can you apply for a Level 2 grant?
One from someone in California, can we apply for a Level 2 grant to remediate a site that was subject of a brownfield community-wide assessment but it's not an eligible brownfield site?
Nope.
No.
Okay.
Can't do that. It's written in RFP. You cannot do that.
We have.
We're very fortunate. Our CARE grant awards, we partner with brownfields, and if you are awarded a CARE grant, you have access to brownfields contract dollars, but only after award.
We have one from Leroy in Arizona. We understand that the project needs to be multimedia. Do Level 2 projects need to address air, water, and land? In Level 1, the community identified one specific problem.
If you did a Level 1 and they identified one specific problem, which I've never heard of, they usually identify more than one problem. If you did a good Level 1 process that looked at all those medias and you went to a Level 2, then you can focus on one specific problem, mm-hmm. but usually a Level 2 has at least two problems they're focusing on. That's what we've been seeing.
And that
we've been saying.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they identified one specific problem, but they did they consider all the media?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's really important. Again, starting out with a blank page, considering all the media.
Okay. Great. The next question is from Leslie in California. This question is regarding the two training conferences required to be attended. How long are these conferences? What budget costs are associated with the conferences?
The conferences are usually at least 3 days, I would say, and it depends upon where they are. We gave you a sample budget in your in the RFP. But just so you know, we've already identified where the next workshop will be. And that will be in San Diego in December. So, for those of you who are trying to plan, the next workshop will be in San Diego in December of 2010.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
I have a question on the phone, if there's time for one.
Okay.
Have you asked a question before?
I have, but it's a follow-up to one that we heard a little earlier. I could wait.
Okay. No, just go ahead. Sure.
I just wanted to try to get a little clarification on something that was said earlier regarding fiscal sponsorship, fiscal agency, and whether that's permissible in the context. And this kind of follows on another one of the questions, where a partner of the existing partnership is the applicant, but essentially the application is you know certainly directed to the partnership that exists. You know, are you applying as yourself, or are you applying as the fiscal sponsor for the partnership?
Apply as yourself, I think, is what we are hearing, is that there's a particular sensitivity to the applying as a fiscal agent. And it sounds like you're a member of the partnership, so just apply as yourself.
Okay. Because last year we applied as a fiscal sponsor. I don't think that, at least as I understand it, that didn't affect our evaluation, but it sounds like there's a slightly different emphasis on that question this year.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to affect the evaluation itself. It's when it gets to the grants office and we start looking at different rules and regulations during that review.
It's
going to
be part of
the
process.
Okay. Thank you.
I was just going to add, it gets to organizational capacity as well. Like, if you were just a fiscal agent and you were not a participating partner and you weren't going to lead the project or manage the project, that would be considered a fiscal agent. And that would show that there's no organizational capacity to do a good job. Whereas, you're applying as yourself, you're a member of the partner, you're going to lead the project, you're going to take responsibility for the project. That shows that you have that capacity. So it's just a crafting of terms, but, you know, you don't want to use the word fiscal agent in your application.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So we have a question from Erlinda in Allentown, Pennsylvania. The City of Allentown is working with a group called the Green Ribbon Committee, which is a collaborative of representatives and groups. The city intends to present an application on behalf of the entire group. We are not a 501c3 organization, but we are tax exempt. Are we at a disadvantage? Yes, because I think you need to be a 501c3.
You have to be a nonprofit.
If you're
a tax exempt, I'm assuming you're a nonprofit.
Yes.
If you can articulate you're a nonprofit, then you can apply for a CARE grant.
And that's covered in the Q's and A's in the citation of OMB Circular A-122. They have the ultimate definition, if you will, of what's a nonprofit. Frank, you know the specifics of that circular?
Not off the top of my head, although just by the applicant's name, City of Allentown, that's going to give us a hint that it's a governmental organization and not a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you're not a nonprofit, don't apply.
I'll
have a first-time question. Back.
Okay.
This is Kurt Kretzinger. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
This is Kurt Kretzinger in Dallas, the Urban Forestry Advisory Committee. Two-part question. Number one, y'all referred to on the line EPA regional persons. Is there a EPA regional grant person for our region that I can visit with? And second,
No. Well, we have to be strict about getting advice from EPA while this is an open competition. So you really shouldn't be talking to any EPA people during this period when you're putting together the RFP through the 4 o'clock on the 9th of March.
Yeah, so everyone has an EPA regional person on the CARE program, but as Dennis was saying, right now it's not advisable for you to do that. Did you want to add to that?
No, I agree with that. If there's questions about forms and things afterwards, the grants office is more than happy to help.
And I want to get back to the question from, I'm sorry, follow-up question. Okay, go
And the second part of my question is, where's the sample on the web that y'all are referring to? The sample applications, RFPs.
There's not a sample, but there's the RFP and the question and answer document, and then on our website there are descriptions of our communities.
And there's two federal forms called the SF-424 and the SF-424A that you have to use. Those are available through APA's website and a whole bunch of other places. Those are forms used for everybody in the government.
And actually, it's in, you can click on a link in the RFP that gets you to that form.
Oh, did, were you referring to the sample budget? I think that's in the
RFP.
RFP. I'm on the site now. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I want to get back to that question from the city person, because, and I did say that you have to be a nonprofit to apply for CARE, but you don't have to just be a nonprofit. Local government can apply for CARE as well, so the city can apply.
And tribes.
And tribes, yes, and universities.
I just wanted to see if we had, we have a number of second-time questioners on the internet. I wanted to turn to the phone and see if we have a second-time questioner, so we'll start switching back and forth again now.
This is Dan again at Magnolia Tree, and I apologize. This is my third question or interjection. And this is more an evaluation, if you'll allow me, of this conference call.
Okay.
As I stated earlier, I thoroughly learned a lot today, and we will be preparing an application and hopefully commit your deadline. So it's been terrific and very informative. On the other hand, it would be useful to me as a level one applicant if maybe you give some consideration to conducting briefings for level one applicants and briefings for level two, because much of the discussion on level two, I already know I'm not at that stage yet. I don't know if anyone else on the line feels the same, but that's just a general suggestion. But overall, you guys are batting the thousand. So take the rest of the day off, and you'll get a pay raise and grade raise.
Well, thanks for being our boss today. Let's just know that on the website there is an evaluation document you can fill out. It's at the front of the website that you when you registered for this Clue-In page webcast. So if you look down to the bottom, I think on the right-hand side, there is a thing that you can press on to evaluate this webcast.
Yeah, we love using feedback like that. Mm-hmm. That's really helpful to get
everybody. That was a good comment.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
So we need to try to get through the rest of these.
Okay, so let me move back to the internet. This one's from Kathleen in Maryland. For the budget section, there's a mandatory travel component. Should we budget for just the key personnel, for example, one person listed on the grant, to go to the conference, annual national training workshop, or for multiple partners to attend the training?
I'll tell you what I've seen, Kathleen. You have to have at least one person there, so it's mandatory that someone is there from your partnership. But I've also seen that they brought a partner with them or someone else who is actually doing some of the work on the ground. So it helps to have more than one person because we do have multiple workshops and sessions, and you may not be able to get to them all. If you have somebody else there, they can go to the sessions that you can't get to.
And we like to think these are valuable, and it's a good use of your time, and you'll go away from it having learned a lot.
If you're not asking questions, please remember to star six your line and mute it. We have numerous follow-up questions from Anjali in California. This one is, can we submit a logic model as an attachment? And is it part of the 10-page limit? We would like to submit a visual logic model. You can definitely submit one, and it can be an attachment rather than part of the 10-page narrative. That people won't be required to look at it if that's the case. So just so you know, please star six your line. If you want it to be absolutely considered by everyone, do include it in the narrative.
But I'm going to make one point here. The term visual. What we get needs to be not video, not any kind of other media. It needs to be something we can read.
It's paper.
It's paper.
or the electronic equivalent of paper.
Mm-hmm. And a follow-up question to that. Last round, there was a 13-page limit, which included the logic model and budget. So am I correct that the page limit is now 10 pages and must still include all of these elements?
Yes, it has to. It's 10 pages. It must include the budget. As Michelle said, you can have the logic model as an attachment. But if you want us to read it, I think you need to put at least some of that into the 10-page, the pertinent information. And you can actually put a table or something in the 10 pages. It doesn't have to be all strictly written.
But many people do read the attachments as well. I absolutely am not saying that people don't read the attachments.
And make sure that you write the attachment in the body of the 10-page application so people know where to turn to.
Mm-hmm. And I would say a little bit about the attachment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Should I just continue through with it?
Yeah, just go through.
Okay, a question from another question from Anjali. Do we need to have letters of commitment from businesses prior to submitting a level one application, or do we describe how we are going to engage them? For level one, they're not required.
For level one, if you have support letters, for example, you're not required to have business. But if you have support letters, we would like to see how that stakeholder is going to engage with you. So your support letter is not just I support your project. If I support your project, and this is what I intend to help with.
Mm-hmm. Remember, I want best case possible.
Mm-hmm.
I would go down.
Okay.
Have you heard from all these?
Yeah, everybody.
Okay.
Another question from Sandra. Okay. We will apply for a care level one if we identify several risks that we want to look at into. Did you say that we have to identify how we decided to pick those particular risks?
For a level one, Sandra, again, I'll refer you to section 1 that talks about on number 5 and 6, which talks about how you need to look at across your community all the risks in your neighborhood, how you need to set priorities. I also refer you to the care roadmap, which also gives you an outline of what you need to do. So you have to articulate a process to look across your community at all your risks. You know, and so you're not really, at that point, you're not identifying it. You're telling us the process you're going to identify it. And then you're talking about the process you're going to use to come to consensus around those risks and to prioritize those risks.
Okay. We have another question from Marion in New York. How much of a business presence is required in the stakeholder group? Marva's addressed that a bit. Is the participation of a business development group, which itself is nonprofit, chamber of commerce, et cetera, mostly sufficient?
If you're a level one, that is definitely sufficient. For level two, we are looking for a little bit more than that. We're looking at some of those businesses or polluting industries that is a part of your project description.
And just so you understand why, remember one important principle of care, that the project will become sustainable after the federal funding. We think it's important to have everyone, including the business community, on board so that that'll happen.
This is Elizabeth from Kansas. Can I jump in with another question?
Sure. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I am wondering about, it says in there several times, and you've said the 5 attachments for a care level 2 application, and up to 50 pages. And I'm a little confused. Are we referring to attachments being literally an attachment in an email, or how is that really organized? Because I'm concerned about the size of the document. I'm thinking of sending it, like, through usendit.com or some other type of way, because I do want to send it electronically if possible. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, I would suggest you PDF it, because if you PDF it, it's easier to come through.
You will send it to the email address that's included in the RFP there.
Okay.
We expect there to be one message, and that message will contain everything that's part of your application.
It will contain the SF-424. It will contain the SF-424A. It will contain the 10-page narrative, and it will contain whatever attachments that you have. You cannot send us multiple emails and expect us to put the pieces together. We will not be able to do that.
That's
and
helpful.
We do say that. I can't remember where, but we do say that one document in total.
Yes, it says that. My only question was you continue to refer to a 5 separate attachments, and I wasn't clear as to what that really means.
No, you can actually in one file have 5 sections, attachment A, B, C, D.
Okay, so it just needs to be distinguished. Got it. Thank you.
Right.
Okay. Thanks for asking that question so we could clarify that.
Sure.
We have another question about those attachments here that I see. For Care Level 2 grantees, do letters of support count as one attachment of the 5 in the 50-page limit? Can I submit 6 letters of support as one attachment?
Sure.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Great. All right. Another question from Anjali. I did see a Level 1 grant awarded to a project focused on healthy homes. How is it possible that they were awarded for this specific focus when it seems clear that you are requesting we submit to examine a broad range of multimedia environmental issues impacting a community? We know how health of people in their homes can be impacted by a number of factors in the community, but is it acceptable to state that this is an area that we want to examine through this care process from the outset, or do we need to examine everything in the community to then come to consensus that we need to address housing-related issues as an outcome?
Yeah, I don't know who you're referring to that focused on healthy homes, but a Level 1 has to have a multimedia focus. What could have came out of that multimedia focus was a healthy homes perspective. And I'm not sure if that was one of our earliest care projects, because if it was one of our 2005 projects, then that was the first time awarded, there might have been some leeway there. But we are not doing that at all. Care projects, Level 1, have to be multimedia, period. And so you have to do it that way.
I wonder and I don't know the project here, it might have been some of our organizations have something like Healthy Homes in the organization name.
Yeah.
That could have happened, but the project would have been a broad range look at multimedia issues.
Yeah, so we don't do it. It has to be multimedia.
We have another from Erlinda in Pennsylvania. Our collaborative has identified a serious problem within our city. We plan to apply and include the cleanup and educational components as part of our care budget. Can this be our single strategy, or do we need to include others to be more competitive?
You have to include others. You can't just talk about paint dumping and electronic equipment and appliances. You have to include, especially for Level 1, you have to include all the various pollutants.
Okay.
It can't be a single strategy.
I think that's all our questions over the internet at this time. Do we have other questions over the phone? It looks like we have a few more minutes. Sorry, we've been just barreling through them.
Yeah.
We'd like to get through everything if we can. Want them to be answered?
Yeah, we can just answer the rest of these, I think.
Sure.
There's 2 more.
Hello? Yes, my name is Ana Rivera. I am from Puerto Rico. I am a little confused with the budget. Do you send the budget as an attachment with the S-424 form, or do you have to write as part of the narrative of the proposal?
You have to do both.
You have to do
a 424, which is basically numbers.
Yeah, just the line item.
And the narrative, you have to correspond the budget with your project goals and performance plan, and that's why we have an example there. So it tells you
that your travel is related to the National Training Workshop. It tells you that you're going to do certain, have certain educational brochures to address something in one of your project goals. So you have to do both.
And just as a recommendation, frankly, do the budget that is part of the application process first and use that to transcribe the numbers into the SF-424A.
Okay. We have another question from another person here at the office. Just hold on, please.
Hello?
Yes?
Hello?
Yes, hello?
Yes, this is Neftali Garcia from Puerto Rico. We are developing a proposal. We have been dealing with the issue of coal combustion ashes in southern Puerto Rico. We have been working with two communities in two different municipalities. And we have dealt with issues of the impact of fly ash on people's health, mostly respiratory ailments. And the ash is being used in roads, dirt roads, in commercial centers, as fill material below houses, and so on. And we are very worried about the impact on surface and underground water and on wetland and lagoon nearby and so on. Would this type of issue, complex issue, is something that appears to be appropriate for this type of proposal?
Well, what type of proposal are you talking about? Because for care level one, you have to look across the community at various environmental media issues. It cannot be just written on coal ash. Not for care level
one. The impact of coal ash through the air on people's health, the impact on public wealth, the impact on agriculture, agricultural soil.
No, I don't mean to cut you off, sir. I'm sorry you got on late, and I don't know if you heard the rest of the webcast, but you cannot just talk about one impact for a care level one.
You would need to go through the, if you look over the RFP, you would need to go through the care process of identifying, of looking at all sources of risk, and going through a community education and consensus building process around the main priorities. So for our grant program,
this would not work for you.
Yes, it might not be the program for you if you already have your one source identified. It would be worth looking a bit more closely at the RFP and just ensuring if you intend to apply for a level two that you've been through the level one process. I think it brings us to the end of our time. Beryl, there were two follow-up statements to your earlier question that didn't look like questions to me. I was a bit confused, so I didn't respond to them as questions. I think follow-up, I guess, on our next webcast.
If she's talking about convincing businesses and help from EPA, once you are awarded, if you're a level one and you do not have business engagement, then your regional team will help you work mm-hmm. with businesses. And the same thing with land uses. So I think that comes into play after award.
Okay. Well, so thank you everyone for tuning in today and for your interest and.
Next call is Friday at 1.
Friday, and you do not need to tune into that unless you wanted to participate in about two more hours and questions and answers.
And also for the gentleman in Puerto Rico, if you haven't had a chance to be on part of this entire webcast, it is audio, it is recorded,
And there will be a recording that you can go back and look and listen to.
Yeah, it takes a couple days, I think, for that to get
out.
But it certainly will be there.
And it tells you that you cannot just look at, I understand what you meant about coal ash. It impacts a variety of things, people's health. But the CARE program, you cannot just look at one impact of one media.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.